Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 105. It's Monday, March 15th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, one of the big questions these days with COVID-19 is about the vaccines that are rolling out, and what can vaccinated people do safely? Well, this is a many-layered thing, and it's a pretty good example of how it's very difficult to compare medical versus public health issues. In other words, individual versus population-based issues, because when the CDC's issuing guidelines, it's looking at the population as a whole. Now, obviously, the population as a whole is composed of many, 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 in this case, tens or hundreds of millions of Americans. But, of course, nobody is at zero risk, so spread out over a large population, you come up with a substantial amount of risk. And it's hard to know what small risk times tens of millions is. So, but, of course, everybody is at some risk if you have any connection with anybody else who has connection with anybody else, which, of course, is pretty much everybody. So, but whatever that level of risk is, it's relative to the amount of virus that's circulating in your community at any given time. And in virtually every state across the nation, this rate is still very high. We are deep into what they call community spread, which is just widespread, where you can't really tell where it's coming from. It's hard to even contact trace all the cases. You don't know if somebody will get a case and they're like, oh, I don't know where I got it from. That's what community spread is. There's a lot of that, and it actually, we could reduce it by several fold and still be in community spread. In fact, the level of spread that Governor Mike DeWine has set for getting rid of masks is still a level of community spread. Maybe not the wisest thing, but of course he's making political calculations on opening businesses and that type of thing, not purely a public health point of view. Okay, well, as far as what vaccinated people can do safely, vaccination is another layer of protection, like social distancing, mask wearing, washing your hands, all these type of things. And the key thing here is that vaccination is by far the best, most effective layer. A vaccinated person's risk is much lower for getting infected at all, probably at least five times less than an unvaccinated person. A vaccinated person's risk is very, very much lower for getting hospitalized or dying. There's nearly 100% protection from hospitalization or death in the clinical trials of the vaccines that are approved in the United States. And there's a much lower chance of transmitting infection to others if a vaccinated person should get infected. So say your one-fifth is likely to get infected, and you're probably not even half as likely to transmit if you are infected. For you math whizzes, that's 0.02, one-fifth, times one-half, 0.05. So 0.2 times 0.5 would equal 0.1. So that means that relatively conservative estimate would mean that the layer of vaccination regarding the chance of a vaccinated person passing along, being a chain in the link where they get infected and pass it along to somebody else, is probably not even a tenth of what it is for an unvaccinated person. This is really good news. And the basic fact that we need to understand when we're looking at what recommendations we need to give to vaccinated persons. But of course, again, you have to get back to this individual versus population risk. So it's fine for vaccinated people to be around low-risk single households where you know there isn't a lot of people and you know what the status and the social connection is with people. So if you happen to infect people, they were people in the same household anyways. So they're kind of in a pod. But if you're like, for instance, with mixed households and you may not know the status as far as risk, and if they're in multiple households, that means you can infect in one single encounter, you know, a visit of multiple households, and you're linked up basically with more chains. So it's a multiples more risk. So that's the type of population-based thinking that the CDC is bringing to these recommendations. So, okay, so it's fine for vaccinated people to be around low-risk people in a single household. But as soon as you merge with mixed households or larger groups, you really need to behave the same as an unvaccinated person because you're dealing with larger numbers and greater uncertainty. Okay, well, vaccines actually are the best at delinking infection from death. And this is at the population level. So basically, even if you had a similar amount of infections in the community, you would have a lot less deaths because people would be protected nearly completely from hospitalizations or deaths. Plus, as the vaccinations are going out, we are targeting these people to the highest risk of severe disease. Now, we can argue, and we do, about how well are we targeting people, but clearly we're targeting, as a whole, people that are higher risk rather than lower risk. So in other words, if we vaccinated 20% of the population, we have probably actually protected the population from multiples of that, probably 40, 60% of the risk of death in the entire population as a whole. Very good news. So even if we see infection rates go up, we're probably not going to see nearly as many deaths. Now, of course, the variants is an issue, and I'll do a story about that too a little bit later. It seems the UK virus is even a little more dangerous, meaning deadly, meaning causing more severe disease per infection than we even originally thought. But even then, particularly for vaccinated people, that doesn't seem to affect. It still is that nearly 100% protection from dying for vaccinated folks. But for the unvaccinated population, it concentrates a higher risk into a smaller group of people and could still be trouble. Okay, well, there's a lot of opinions about the CDC guidance about whether, you know, it's too lax or too strict. And this is one that I thought was worth covering. This from the Washington Post, an opinion piece. The CDC is missing a critical opportunity to get Americans vaccinated. After much delay, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued guidance for what fully vaccinated people can do. While some guidance is better than no guidance, the guidelines are too timid and too limited, and they fail to tie reopening guidance with vaccination status. As a result, the CDC missed a critical opportunity to incentivize Americans to be vaccinated. Unvaccinated people from different households still shouldn't mingle, the CDC says. That I agree with. What I take issue with is the CDC's silence on activities outside the home, such as traveling, attending church services, and going to restaurants for fully vaccinated people. In fact, it says these people should continue the same precautions in these settings as unvaccinated individuals. This fails the common sense test. The CDC said nearly a month ago that vaccinated individuals, if asymptomatic, do not need to quarantine or get tested if exposed to someone with COVID-19. If risk of infection is so low that even exposure to the virus doesn't require quarantine, why can't we say that vaccinated people can resume activities around people who probably don't have COVID-19? Take flying on an airplane. The risk of infection during air travel is already very low when all passengers are masked. Surely that risk is even lower for vaccinated people. Why can't the CDC say that vaccinated people can travel without having to quarantine or get tested? I think, in fact, we should go further and encourage those fully vaccinated to travel. The CDC can specify that they should be careful once they get to their destination. Don't go to parties with people of unknown vaccination status, for example, but it's fine to visit extended family, go to beaches and parks, and tour cultural sites while wearing masks in public places. How about other social spaces? As is the case for most public health decisions, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. The CDC can provide nuanced and risk estimates instead of taking an absolutist approach. Let's say it's really important for an elderly vaccinated person to resume in-person church services. I think that person can and should go because the risk of infection is exceedingly low compared with the benefit of their mental and spiritual health. Another person might be desperate to go to a restaurant, hair salon, or the gym. Vaccination means that they should regain these freedoms with caution, including masking and physical distancing when possible. Healthcare providers need to help people exercise good judgment while considering each person's individual values, or else we lose their trust. Public health must shift its outlook from zero risk to manageable risks that can strike the right balance of controlling infection and restoring the economy. That outlook should have also involved calculated risks to take now to end the pandemic later. I've written before about my concern that the single biggest impediment to reaching herd immunity will be vaccine hesitancy. People need to be given incentives to get the vaccine. I know that for those desperate to be vaccinated, it's unimaginable that someone could turn down safe and highly effective vaccines that could save their lives. But the reality is that millions of Americans will not get vaccinated unless they see something in it for them. That something is the freedom to return to normalcy. As more states lift restrictions, the Biden administration has a narrow window to tie reopening policy to vaccination. It can suggest to states, for example, that businesses do not need capacity limits for fully vaccinated people. But if businesses are not checking vaccination status, they should still limit capacity indoors. Interstate and international travel should require pre-travel testing and post-travel quarantine, which would be waived for people with proof of vaccination. Yes, there's a risk of those vaccinated could still be low-level carriers of the coronavirus. That risk is offset by the greater risk of waiting. At some point soon, everything will be fully reopened anyway, and there will be no carrot left to offer. To have our best chance of achieving herd immunity and ending the pandemic once and for all, vaccines should be presented as the ticket back to pre-pandemic life. Time is running out for the CDC and the Biden administration to embrace this approach. Well, there's something, another perspective to think about. Okay, and of course, recommendations are that just recommendations, and we still have this hodgepodge of state recommendations, patchwork across the country. This from the Hill: reckless governors are threatening COVID-19 progress. Although we can now see the light at the end of the tunnel, we aren't there yet. Reckless and premature rollbacks in states like Texas and Mississippi, and soon to be others, threaten to erode the hard-won progress we've made and create pockets of potential new infections. As we face the growing threat of alarming virus variants, the best tool we still have in the race to vaccinate a majority of Americans continue to be mask wearing and physical distancing. Here's why. Although cases have dropped significantly around the country, the outbreak in Texas is as bad as it was in the summer. On July 2nd, Texas recorded over 7,900 cases and 44 deaths, an alarming figure that led Governor Greg Abbott to finally institute a statewide mask mandate. Yet, on the same day that he announced the mask mandate was ending, there were also 7,747 cases and some 271 deaths. So it's kind of, this is the whole weird thing in their psychology about this pandemic, that when it's going up, we're alarmed at the same level, but when it's going down, but the infection in the community and the deaths are just as great, somehow we have a completely different view about it. Well, like I said, the main thing that modulates our risk is in fact the amount of infection that's circulating around in our community. And Texas has a lot of it circulating right now. Okay, and to the story I alluded to earlier, this from Science Daily. Variant B117 of COVID-19 associated with a significantly higher mortality rate, research shows. The highly infectious variant of COVID-19 discovered in Kent, which swept across the UK last year before spreading worldwide, is between 30 and 100% more deadly than previous strains, new analysis has shown. It showed that the new variant led to 227 deaths in a sample of about 55,000 patients, compared to 141 amongst the same number of closely matched patients who had the previous strains. With the new variant already detected in more than 50 countries worldwide, the analysis provides crucial information to governments and health officials to help prevent its spread. Now, this is a pretty big study, but if you take the raw numbers, the amount of patients, you had 141 that died with the wild virus, the original strain, and then 227 that died with the new strain. That's actually a 61% increase. But like the title, like the story says, they consider that between 30 and 100% because obviously there's some uncertainty. There's some conditions that you can't totally drill down in with certainty. And as you might remember, they were talking about 30 to 50% before. So this is actually an upgrade. As we get better data, it actually looks like it's somewhat more deadly than we originally thought.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, in somewhat better news, this from the Hill. Pfizer vaccine neutralizes so-called Brazilian virus variant in new study. The Pfizer vaccine was able to neutralize a coronavirus variant first identified in Brazil in a new lab study, a positive sign for the vaccine's effectiveness. Neutralization of the so-called Brazilian variant, known as P1, was roughly equivalent to the original strain of the virus, which the Pfizer vaccine has been shown to be highly effective against, researchers wrote in a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, this is an important story because the Brazilian variant seems to be really nasty, one that's able to reinfect people. And like the South African variant, they're very concerned that it might eat away at the effectiveness of vaccines. So this is good news that the Pfizer vaccine, which is a similar technology as the Moderna, so you'd probably expect similar results, did well against the so-called Brazil variant. Good news. Okay, folks, well, there's a lot of moving parts in this pandemic, and the CDC's recommendations are trying to triangulate all of those moving parts. It's not something that's a recommendation set for all time, it's something that's dependent upon the conditions on the ground at any given time. And here's a story about some relaxed guidance from the Washington Post. Federal officials relaxed guidance on nursing home visits, citing vaccines and slowing infections. Federal health officials said last Wednesday that they could substantially relax the government's guidelines for family and friends to see nursing home residents in person, saying the vaccinations and a slowing of coronavirus infections in the facilities warrant restoring indoor visits in most situations. The nursing home guidance, the first federal advice on the subject since September, says outdoor visitation is preferred even when a nursing home resident and family or friends are fully vaccinated against the novel coronavirus. But acknowledging that weather or a resident's poor health might make an outdoor visit impractical, the recommendations encourage nursing homes to permit indoor visits, quote, at all times and for all residents, regardless of whether people have been vaccinated, except in a few circumstances. Federal officials say the exceptions include when a resident has not been fully immunized against the virus and lives at home in which fewer than 70% of fellow residents are fully vaccinated, and when the nursing home is in a community with high rates of local infections, more than 10% of the tests being positive. That's the test positivity rate. Visitors are also discouraged from seeing residents who have COVID-19 or are in quarantine after having been exposed to the virus. Katie Smith Sloan, president of Leading Age, an association of nonprofit providers of aging services, said, "This is the right thing to do, given the progress in vaccinating nursing home residents and staff. There is no substitute for an in-person visit, even in nursing homes that have gone to extraordinary lengths to support residents and find creative ways to keep them connected with loved ones throughout the pandemic." The nursing home guidance issued by the Centers for Medicaid Services in coordination with the CDC acknowledges the pandemic's harrowing impact on some of the nation's oldest and frailest people who make up nursing home populations. "We acknowledge the toll that separation and isolation has taken," the document says. "We also acknowledge that there is no substitute for physical contact, such as a warm embrace between a resident and their loved one. For those reasons," the guidance says, "a fully vaccinated nursing home resident can choose to have close contact, including touch, with their visitor while wearing a well-fitted face mask and performing hand hygiene before and after. Those visitors," the guidance said, "should maintain a safe distance from the nursing home's other residents and staff." The recommendations say compassionate care visits, including when a resident is nearing death, should be allowed at all times. They should be permitted even when a resident is unvaccinated, the facility has a COVID-19 outbreak, or a community has high infection rates. The latest guidance says visits can still occur during a COVID-19 outbreak at a nursing home as long as the virus's spread appears to be contained to one area. If tests show no new cases elsewhere in the facility, visits may still take place in the other areas, the recommendations say. The American Healthcare Association announced last week that COVID-19 cases among its members' facilities had declined 82% since late December to early February. Okay, next up from PBS. Politics still drives how Americans feel about COVID response 1 year in. How people think the country should approach the pandemic and what it should prioritize continues to fall along deep political lines, according to the latest PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll. New, more easily transmissible variants of COVID-19 have been identified in almost every state in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported. And 51% of Americans think their state must prioritize controlling the spread of virus, even if it hurts the economy. But 43% of Americans think restarting the economy should take precedence over trying to contain the virus's spread. And multiple governors have either already lifted mask mandates and restrictions on businesses in their states, or have announced plans to do so in the coming days. 36% of adults know someone who has died of COVID, while 30% say they don't want to be vaccinated. What matters most to Americans during the pandemic? The challenge of combating the pandemic and its economic fallout has spurred the desire for action and for compromise, but Americans are split on which issue to tackle first. 43% said vaccine distribution is their top priority, while 21% said reopening schools was more important. In this latest poll, 78% of Democrats said they think their state should stop the spread of coronavirus, even if it hurts the economy. But 74% of Republicans and states need to prioritize the economy over the pandemic. How Americans view the vaccine rollout. Those who want to get vaccinated but have not yet received a shot include 52% of Latino Americans, 48% of Black Americans, and 43% of White Americans. I would note that more whites have been vaccinated. So actually, with the folks that are left unvaccinated, there's a higher proportion of Black Americans that want to get vaccinated than white Americans. So all this reporting about Black Americans with vaccine hesitancy, while that's somewhat true, because of the disparities in access, there's actually a higher proportion of Black Americans that are unvaccinated that actually want to get vaccinated than white Americans. Okay, continuing with the story. But 30% of Americans said they do not plan to get vaccinated, including 41% of Republicans and 49% of Republican men. There you go, folks. There's the group that's the most recalcitrant as far as protecting their own health and theirs of the community. That is 49% of Republican men do not plan to get vaccinated. Okay, well, vaccination efforts are ramping up, and I want to do an excerpt from this article from The Hill. Five things that must happen to get people vaccinated. After a brutal year fighting COVID-19, the country is seeing some glimmers of hope on the horizon. President Biden put forward new specific dates in a primetime address last Thursday night, saying all American adults will be eligible for the vaccine by May 1st at the latest, and that the country will be closer to normal by the 4th of July. the Biden administration announced a range of steps to try to make the vaccine more accessible. It will send the vaccine to an additional 750 community health centers, bringing the total to 950. It will double the number of pharmacies receiving vaccines to more than 20,000. The administration has opened 20 federally run mass vaccination centers and announced plans to double that number. To add more people to administer vaccinations, Biden also announced an additional 4,000 active duty troops and opened up eligibility to be a vaccinator to groups such as dentists, paramedics, and veterinarians. The Biden administration said that it will set up a federal website showing people the locations near them that have vaccines available starting by May 1st. Okay, well, let's move to the local COVID-19 update. The average number of daily cases, newly identified infections in Lucas County dropped slightly to 79 per day, down from 84 in the previous week. And in Ohio, 68 of 88 Ohio counties are still in the high incidence, but this is 11 more counties that have moved out of high in the past week. These are actually all rural counties. Okay, the testing positivity rate for Lucas County actually reversed course and went up to 6.5. We were at 5.7 the previous week, hoping to move down to that magical metric of 5% or less, which is an indication that you're doing enough testing in the community. So hopefully Lucas County isn't the canary in the coal mine, but it looks like there's higher levels of cases up in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. So we might have a kind of a cluster regionally here. Ohio as a whole did move down in their testing positivity rate down to 3% from 3.2%. Congratulations, Ohio. The average amount of time it takes for a positive test to be returned to the health department has edged up over the last several weeks and holds at 2.85 days. Of course, we like to see that. The magical metric there is 24 to 48 hours, so we've been over that pretty much the whole pandemic. But continued good news in long-term care facilities, nursing homes. We moved down to a new record low. We plummeted down to 5 active cases the previous week, and we bumped that down even to 4. There's only one resident in Lucas County with an active COVID-19 case and 3 staff. Good news, people. Vaccinations work. New hospitalizations have leveled off in Ohio this last week, so the long decline seems to have ended. We'll have to see where it goes from there. Well, the death rates in Ohio still seem to require some sorting out, so I won't be reporting on those. That's been a couple months now here. Okay, well, the University of Toledo, back in session, only had 15 active cases, 15 new infections identified. That was down from 23, up from 11 the week before that, but low historically, and their surveillance testing, that random testing they do on campus, had only a 0.4% positivity, which is the same it's been the couple weeks prior to that as well. So pretty good for University of Toledo. Lucas County schools had an increase from 70 to 82 identified infections, but a somewhat marked decrease in the amount of staff that are positive and an uptick in the amount of students that are positive. And again, there isn't any regular testing program in our schools, so it's really kind of hard to say what all this means. But one interesting thing that has evolved over the last couple months is that when the Lucas County schools were remote, only about 10% of new infections in Lucas County were identified in ages 0 to 19. Now that number is over 20%. So we're seeing a shift to the youngest people with new infections. And that makes sense as the vaccinations have started off in the elderly population. We've seen large decreases in the proportion of cases that are coming from people over age 60. And as we just move that down to age 50, we'll see those cases go even lower. Okay, well, on the vaccine front, we've seen the proportion of population that's had at least one dose move over 20% at the state, local, and national level. Over 70 million doses nationally, 2.5 million statewide, and over 90,000 in Lucas County have gotten their vaccinations at least started. Okay, well, one thing I've started tracking is racial ethnic disparities in vaccinations. And Currently, with the most recent data, Lucas County blacks are 45% as likely to be vaccinated as Lucas County whites. That's a rate, my friend, adjusted towards the size of the population. This is a slight increase. It started out at 38%, but we're actually doing a little worse in Lucas County than Ohio as a whole. Ohio blacks are 49% as likely to be vaccinated as Ohio whites. Okay, well, if you're eligible or wondering if you're eligible, you can find out information and even get an appointment to get vaccinated at gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. Again, that's gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. And in Lucas County, you can dial 211 if you need language assistance or have poor internet access. If you're over age 65, you can call the Area Office of Aging at 419-382-0624, or any Lucas County resident can visit any county library branch to schedule an appointment. Or you can call the library at 419-259-5200. You are listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, just for the health of it, on WAKT, We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, next up, an interesting article from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Governor Mike DeWine's vaccination priorities are shockingly biased. This reporting by Leela Atassi. If you're among the 30% of Ohioans dealing with obesity, you probably have spent the past year terrified that COVID-19 will kill you. From the start of the pandemic, you've been told time and time again that obesity is near the top of a short list of underlying conditions that exponentially increase your risk for severe COVID illness, hospitalization, or death. Perhaps you expected Ohio's vaccine deployment strategy to recognize that and make you a priority. And if Ohio were a state that made those decisions based on data and ethics, you might be vaccinated by now. Instead, after immunizing seniors first, Ohio's vaccination protocol for phases 1B and 1C outrageously excludes obesity, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, smoking, and a variety of heart issues from the list of medical conditions that enable people to move closer to the front of the line. Why might that be? One troubling explanation is that all of those conditions are often wrongly considered self-inflicted, brought on by one's lifestyle choices. It might sound cynical to suggest that the Ohio Department of Health would base its vaccination priorities on judgmental attitudes about whether a person is to blame for their own diseases. When I asked ODH about it, a spokesperson issued this opaquely written statement, acknowledging that priority was, indeed, given to congenital or childhood-acquired illnesses. Mark Alusio, Department of the Chair of Bioethics at Case Western Reserve University, told me that the state should be careful about, quote, wading into the deep water of judging causal and moral responsibility for certain diseases. The list definitely leaves you with a sense that they deprioritize these groups because the powers that be deem some large percentage of them to be responsible for their own health status. That's probably true of how these decisions were made, and that's a notoriously problematic move. Alusio pointed out that if someone is driving recklessly and injured in a car accident, doctors wouldn't deny that person medical treatment based on the fact that they caused their own injury. Nor would they deny a ventilator to a COVID patient who had refused to wear a mask in public. Examples become ever more complex as we consider how society views one's personal responsibility for addiction and other diseases with psychosocial underpinnings. Alusio made the distinction that we're talking about vaccine prioritization here, not outright refusal of medical care, but the ethical considerations are similar. Public health policy based on judgments of personal responsibility is dangerous and often indefensible. Judging obesity as a self-inflicted disease is especially inappropriate. The causes of obesity are complex, as Dr. W. Scott Booch, Director of Obesity Medicine at the Bariatric and Metabolic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic, a decline in the quality of available food, chronic stress, sleep deprivation, changes to the body's microbiome, medications, disruptions to the endocrine system, and heredity are just some of the factors that contribute to the disease. And powerful hormonal responses can thwart even the most earnest efforts at weight loss, Booch said. And yet many unfairly view those who have obesity as lazy, gluttonous, and undisciplined. Booch said those biases seep into every aspect of society, from employment to healthcare. Every day he sees patients whose lives are affected in profound and heartbreaking ways by obesity. And this past year, living with the disease has also meant living with a crippling fear of COVID. People with obesity are 46% more likely to test positive, 113% more likely to be hospitalized, and 66% more at risk of needing mechanical ventilation, said Booch, who is also chair of the Policy and Advocacy Committee for the Obesity Society. What's more, deprioritizing obesity could deepen racial inequity in the vaccine distribution system because communities of color experience obesity at significantly higher rates than their white counterparts. Obviously, with such high obesity rates in the state, Ohio tried to avoid overwhelming its limited vaccine supply by first vaccinating smaller categories of high-risk patients. That logic is not lost on me, but many other states have found equitable ways to decide who goes first without judgmentally excluding those who face the greatest risk. What the state of Ohio is doing is unsupported by data, and more importantly, it's cruel. In a time when empathy and compassion should matter more than ever before, DeWine's health department clearly has brought into some of society's most contemptible prejudices to disenfranchise millions who are the most in need of immunization. Of course, with the recent surge in vaccine production and the FDA approval of Johnson & Johnson's single-shot inoculation, these ethical debates about who should have early access, hopefully, will be rendered moot in a matter of months. But hundreds of Ohioans will die of COVID while we wait. We have the chance right now to protect our most vulnerable. We must rely on science and data, not wrong-headed biases, to tell us who they are. Okay, I will note that the state of Ohio has not been reluctant to open up vaccination to large swaths of the population, and I do find it a little surprising, and I think this is a legitimate critique that obesity has not been included. And this varies by states. I mean, like Illinois opened it up to smokers, for instance, but that's not popular because people say, well, smoking, that's something you control, and don't want to, like, quote, reward people. But non-judgment is a really important principle in public health, and we're looking at preventing outcomes. We're not looking about making moral judgments about people. We just want to keep people healthy. And for instance, in Lucas County, with the most recent expansion of vaccine eligibility, 84,000 new Lucas County folks have become eligible. And the health department is getting about 10,000, or the Lucas County as a whole is getting about 10,000 doses per week. You know, it's obvious that it's going to take weeks and weeks and weeks just to catch up with that. So they're way ahead. And I've commented on this before that we have multiples of people that are eligible for every vaccination spot in any given week. The prioritization, you know, you can make a lot of arguments about who should come first. I know that the health department made the comment that this excessive demand, quote, makes our job easier. It's nice to have an easy job, but it's also kind of the opposite of targeting if you're relying people to beat down your door rather than you going out and actually tracking down and reaching the highest risk, hardest to reach people. Now, we do have a lot of capacity when vaccines come down. In fact, the health commissioner said that the rec center, which is a max vaccination site, they actually have the capacity to do 20,000 vaccinations a week. And they're doing a fraction of that, more like 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 a week. So as vaccines become more available, it seems we do have the infrastructure to get it out there. Of course, getting it out equitably is an important consideration as well. Okay, we'll have a couple more Ohio stories. This is from Spectrum News Report. Ohio lags in public health preparedness. With the end of COVID-19 restrictions in sight, it might be tempting to focus on something other than healthcare, but that is the exact opposite advice given to public policymakers coming from the Trust for America's Health, a public policy research organization. The group's policy director, Rhea Farberman, said the COVID-19 pandemic shows why public health requires consistent attention. "We weren't as prepared as we should have been for the pandemic," Farberman said. "That's something that the public health experts have been warning us about for decades." Last Wednesday, the group released its Ready or Not report. The name reflects reality. Ohio ranked as one of the least prepared states for future health emergencies. "We have an unfortunate pattern of paying attention to public health and investing in public health during an emergency. And then once the emergency fades, we neglect the public health infrastructure." Report indicators include hospital quality, collaboration between hospitals, and system capacity for testing and treatment. "Measuring preparedness is also tricky in that planning for outcomes and delivering during a crisis are two different things. Anticipation is key." "Infrastructure is so critical," Farberman said. You have to have that infrastructure that anticipates scenario A, scenario B, scenario C, and plan for it. Farberman said the group's report is broadly focused because the real-world hazards are unpredictable. One of the things we have to understand is that although we know there'll be future emergencies, we don't know exactly what type they will be, and that's why we have something called all hazards preparedness, Farberman said. So you have a general level of preparedness to protect health, regardless of whether it's an infectious disease or a wildfire, fire, flooding, or a foodborne illness. The state has to have certain capacities to protect health during an emergency. There is some good news in the report. Even with limited public dollars to spend, Ohio managed the eighth highest spending increase in public health in fiscal year 2019. But the report put the Buckeye State in the lowest preparedness tier, in part because Ohio ranks the lowest in the percentage of hospitals in healthcare coalitions that focus on response preparedness. For Farberman, this means more work and more investment. Our system right now is underfunded and archaic, frankly, she said. And we need to rebuild that. Okay, well, next up, and good news for a boost to our public health infrastructure, this from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Ohio looks to form new statewide support system for child and adolescent behavioral health. Ohio will create a statewide center that will offer support to child and adolescent behavioral health programs and agencies, including providing services to keep children out of foster care. Ohio's Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Center for Excellence will offer training and technology and administrative services, including increased access to government support through telehealth. Multiple departments, including Job and Family Services and the Mental Health and Addiction Services, created the request for qualified contractors to help develop the center. Ohio is working on multiple statewide programs to reform its child care and protection system, including implementing the Family First Prevention Services Act, which offers services to keep children with families and out of foster care, and Ohio RISE, a program through Ohio Medicaid, which assists families with children that have high behavioral health needs. By having the central support system, Ohio can make sure its initiatives are progressing and that the state has the capacity to expand behavioral health services. The center will also develop an assessment system to make sure programs are effective. Okay, well, getting mental health services is a particularly challenging corner of our challenged healthcare system. And I want to read some of this fact sheet from the physicians from a national health program. This is entitled, Medicare for All Means Mental Health Care for All. Why can't Americans get the mental health care we need? More than half, 57% of Americans with mental illness, including 90% with substance use disorder and 73% of youth with severe depression, cannot access treatment. While 11% of adults with mental illness are uninsured, a majority have commercial insurance plans but still can't get the needed care. Why? Commercial insurers discriminate against mental health care. 1. Insurers pay less for mental health care. Plans pay mental health providers 24% less than primary care providers for similar services, causing mental health providers to opt out of insurance networks. Only 55% of psychiatrists accept commercial insurance, a 17% drop since 2006, compared to 90% of other physicians. Payment disparities worsen provider shortages. 80% of counties outside core metro areas have no psychiatrists. 61% had no psychologists. 2. Insurers limit our choice of providers. A visit to a mental health provider is 6 to 10 times more likely to be out of network compared to a primary care provider. Insurance networks are so limited that patients are forced to wait weeks or months for appointments, travel long distances, or seek costly care from an out-of-network provider. Many simply give up. 3. Insurers limit or deny common treatments such as medication, therapy, and hospitalization. The nation's largest insurer, United Behavioral Health, was recently found guilty of denying 67,000 claims for mental health care based on financial, not medical, reasons. Medicare for All means better health and lower costs. The evidence is clear. Ignoring mental health leads to more sickness, more death, and higher costs for everyone. Medicare for All would eliminate the greed and waste of commercial insurance and cover everybody in the U.S. for all medically necessary care, including prescriptions and services for behavioral and mental health and substance use disorder. Coverage is lifelong with no interruptions, co-pays, or deductibles. And unlike commercial insurance, Medicare for All provides free choice of hospital and provider, including psychiatrists, psychologists, and licensed counselors. It's time to invest in America's mental health. It's time for Medicare for All.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, next up, this from Science Daily. Life expectancy falling for adults without a bachelor's degree. Life expectancy in the United States dropped in 2020 due to COVID-19, but for American adults without a college degree, the increase in mortality in adulthood occurred even earlier, according to a new study authored by Ann Case and Sir Angus Deaton of Princeton University. Since 2010, people without a college degree have experienced an absolute rise in mortality, the researchers reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Meanwhile, people with a college degree have experienced a decrease in mortality. Yet, while the gap in the United States widened based on whether people had a four-year college degree, it narrowed based on race. By 2018, black Americans with a bachelor's degree were much closer to whites with a degree in terms of life expectancy than to black Americans without a degree, a sharp contrast to the early 1990s. The results illustrate the increasing influence of educational attainment on a person's health and economic security in the United States. America is the richest large country in the world with frontier medical technology, yet we still see large declines for Americans without a four-year degree, even prior to arrival of COVID-19. Without a four-year college diploma, it is increasingly difficult to build a meaningful and successful life in the United States. Given that today, two-thirds of adults in America do not have a four-year college degree, this is a significant finding. When bringing education into the fold, Case and Deaton found the drop in expected years to live was for those without a bachelor's degree. Black men and women with a bachelor's degree, who used to have a lower adult life expectancy than whites without a degree, now had more expected years to live. In addition to deaths of despair, contributing factors also include obesity, smoking, and cardiovascular disease, the researchers said. Wage declines and a dearth of jobs may also play a role. And this is a perfect example of how, you know, having the so-called best medical care in the world, along with high tech anyways, doesn't exactly translate into population-based health. And the fact that people can't even have income security definitely affects our health as a whole. And income is highly correlated to level of education. Okay, well, as we see better data, we see a refining of recommendations. This from The Hill. U.S. expert panel says lung cancer screenings for smokers should now start at age 50. A leading panel of experts broadened its recommendations for who should get yearly screenings for lung cancer, saying smokers should now get started getting screened at age 50. The new recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force will nearly double the number of people eligible for a yearly CT scan to try to detect lung cancer early. The recommendations are now for people to get screened if they are age 50 to 80, who have smoked at least a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years, and either still smoke or have quit within the last 15 years. Those are broader criteria than the previous recommendations, lowering the age of to begin screenings from 55 to 50 and lowering the number of years of smoking history from 30 to 20. Under the Affordable Care Act, insurers are required to cover preventive services recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force at no cost to the patient. The panel said the changes would make more black people and women eligible for screenings and pointed to data showing black people are at higher risk than white people. Lung cancer kills more people than any other cancer, according to the American Cancer Society, which estimates that about 131,000 people will die from it in the United States in 2021, with about 235,000 new cases this year. Okay, and more on that story, this from Science Daily. New lung cancer screening recommendation starting at age 50 expands access but may not address inequities. Calling the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force's newly released recommendation statement to expand eligibility for annual lung cancer screening with low-dose CT a step forward, University of North Carolina Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center researchers say future changes should address equity and implementation issues. The revised U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations are sound and based on well-conceived evidence and modeling studies, but they alone are not enough as we have seen limited uptake of the prior recommendations. Implementation will require broader efforts by payers, health systems, and professional societies, and in the future, a more tailored individual risk prediction approach may be preferable. The task force has made two significant changes to the screening recommendation it issued in 2013. Annual screening will begin at age 50 instead of 55, and smoking intensity has been reduced from 30 to 20 pack year history. These more inclusive criteria could more than double the number of adults eligible for lung cancer screening from 6.4 million to 14.5 million. This represents an 81% increase. The authors are encouraged that lung cancer screening will be available to more people, and they point out that expanding access alone won't reduce racial inequities, especially by as measured by lung cancer deaths prevented and life years gained. Financial-based barriers are also an issue. Expanding screening access to include people as young as 50 may lead to greater inequities for those who are enrolled in Medicaid, the state-based public insurance program. Medicaid is not required to cover the task force recommended screenings, and even when screening is covered, Medicaid programs may use different eligibility criteria. This is problematic because people who receive Medicaid are twice as likely to be current smokers than those with private insurance, 26.3% compared to 11.1%, and they are disproportionately affected by lung cancer. This is a significant issue, particularly in the 9 states where Medicaid does not cover lung cancer screening. Now, you'll note from the earlier study, they were talking about how the task force recommendations are required under Obamacare, but that only affects the commercial plans, does not affect Medicaid, which is almost a quarter of the population. And of course, like it said, has way more smokers. Okay, back to the story. Putting the screening recommendation into practice will be a substantial challenge. Primary care providers are critical to implementing the screening process because they initiate the conversation with their patients about the potential benefits and risk of lung cancer screening and making the screening referral. However, many already have an overburdened workload, and it may be unrealistic to expect them to be able to spend the necessary time to have these complex conversations. Despite these limitations and challenges, the new recommendation can expand access to lung cancer screening. Beyond implementation challenges, the future of screening strategies lies in individualized risk assessment, including genetic risk. The 2021 Task Force Recommendation Statement represents a leap forward in evidence and offers promise to prevent more cancer deaths and address screening disparities. But the greatest work lies ahead to ensure this promise is actualized. Okay, next up, let's switch gears a little bit. This from Carbon Brief. Food systems responsible for 1/3 of human-caused emissions. Food systems are responsible for 34% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions in 2015, according to new research. According to the study, 71% of food emissions in 2015 came from agriculture and associated land use and land use change activities. The rest stem from retail, transport, consumption, fuel production, waste management, industrial processes, and packaging. The study finds that CO2 accounts for roughly half of food-related emissions, while methane makes up 35%, mainly from livestock production, farming, and waste treatment. Emissions from the retail sector are rising, the study finds. It increased by 3 to 4 times in Europe and the U.S. between 1990 and 2015. The authors also find that food miles contribute less to food emissions than packaging. The authors added that 96% of the emissions from transporting food come from local or regional transport by road and rail rather than international transport. And on a personal note, I would just note when I first started dabbling with vegetarianism, I was actually more interested in kind of, world hunger stewardship, and found that high levels of packaging and processing more offensive than the divide between animal and plant. And from an environmental point of view, this seems to be here confirmed by the fact that packaging itself is one of the most unecologically sustainable aspects of our food system, even more so than transporting food long distances. Okay, well, I want to close today's show with an article, very interesting, talking about the nutrition guidelines, which decline to even consider the ecological effects within the guidelines. And this story accents why, in fact, that would be important. This from Science Daily. Greenhouse gas emissions associated with dietary guidelines vary between countries. Greenhouse gas emissions associated with national dietary guidelines advocating a healthy diet vary greatly between countries, with U.S. guidelines having the largest carbon footprint and India having the smallest, according to a study involving seven countries published in the Open Access Nutrition Journal. The variations result from differences in recommendations for and consumption of individual foods within the six main food groups: protein foods, dairy, grains, fruits, vegetables, and oils or fats. Diego Rose, the corresponding author, said, "Many countries provide recommendations about foods that people should eat for a healthy diet, and previous simulations have shown that if the public were to eat according to their government's recommendations, their diet would be both healthier and have a lower carbon footprint. However, for the U.S., the opposite has been shown. Greenhouse gas emissions were simulated to go up if people followed the dietary guidelines. This anomaly prompted us to investigate how dietary guidelines vary between countries and the consequent implications for greenhouse gas emissions." Brittany Kovacs, one of the authors, said, "These findings hold insights for future development of dietary guidelines and highlight the importance of including sustainability considerations, such as reductions in protein, food, and dairy recommendations, and/or the inclusion of more plant-based substitutions for animal-based products. By including more sustainable, yet still health-based considerations into dietary recommendations, it is possible to influence the environmental impacts of the larger food and agriculture sector in various countries and worldwide." Okay, well, as you know, all of the articles that I cover on my show are available. There's links to the original articles, which may be much longer as I edit them down for your benefit, for to consume a lot more news quickly. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, and I'm also posting some bonus articles that I won't report much on, but are also good long reads that go into depth. So I have three bonus articles this week. First, Environmental Racism: Why Long Beach Residents of Color Have Worse Health Outcomes. Communities that lack open spaces have fewer healthy food options and are closer to freeways have worse health compared to the general population. And the folks who live in those communities, research has shown, tend to be low-income people of color. Woohoo! We'll see more on the website. And related to that, environmental justice plays a key role in Biden's COVID-19 stimulus package. The rescue plan includes an unprecedented $100 million in funding for action on air pollution and environmental health risks in marginalized communities. And lastly, thirdly, gun control groups focus all efforts on Senate. Background check legislation would require unlicensed or private sellers to conduct a check before they transfer a firearm, and another measure would extend the time federal investigators have to perform background checks from 3 days to 10 days. The NRA's weakened state is also adding optimism to gun control advocates. The once powerful pro-gun lobbying group filed for bankruptcy and announced in January that it will reincorporate in Texas and leave New York. It's facing a civil suit from the New York Attorney General. Okay, well, you can get more at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always." And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.